nations under siege, attackers from within. Rally round, oh glory, rally once more. Wait for America, what are you for?
Welcome to The People Speak. I am Malik Johnson, and today we have the outspoken, tenacious, courageous, highly respected, and esteemed Daniel Robert Graham. Bob Graham was the governor of Florida from 1979 to 1987 and a United States senator from 1987 to 2005. After removing himself out of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination on October 6, 2003, Bob Graham announced his retirement from the United States Senate. Thank you, former Senator, and Bob Graham. Thank you for joining us on The People Speak.
Thank you very much, Malik. I appreciate this chance. It's the first time I've had an opportunity to talk with your listeners, viewers, audience.
You know, before the interview, I briefly asked the senator, I said, shall I call you former Senator Bob Graham? Shall I call you Senator Bob Graham? Or shall I just call you Bob? He said, you can call me anything you want to call.
I said that my grandchildren call me Doodle, and that's my preferred title.
Hey, how was your 4th of July celebration yesterday?
Calm, quiet. I'm doing some writing, and I took advantage of a few hours away from the office and telephone to get some actual work accomplished.
Thank you for coming here. And thinking about this interview yesterday, I saw the various colors of fireworks, and I couldn't stop thinking about the detailed logs that you keep on a daily basis of your daily activities on color-coded notebooks. Do you still do that, Senator?
As we speak, Malik, your name is going down into my latest book, which is 707A, which means it's the first book in July of 2007.
Thank you for having me. I
know I've taken a lot of kidding about those, but for me, they are a precursor to the modern computer-based technology, and they're my means of trying to stay somewhat organized.
And you are very much organized. I think sometimes when I was looking at your bio, I said, wow, this man is super ultra organized. And I said, well, I could learn a lot from him. And Bush could learn a lot from you as well. You know, the authorization to use the armed forces, you know, you never supported the joint resolution to authorize the use of the United States Armed Forces against Iraq, approved October 16, 2002. You were on the Senate Intelligence Committee for 10 years and chaired it for two. What is it that you knew at that time in your position that George Bush did not, and which led you not to support the joint resolution?
Well, I knew the following. First, that the greatest enemies we faced in the Middle East and Central Asia were not in Iraq, that they were Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they were Hezbollah in Syria and Lebanon, they were the state of Iran, and that we were making a serious error focusing our military on a lesser threat, while the greater threats were allowed to regroup and strengthen. Number two, I had strong doubts about the validity, the credibility, the truthfulness of what we were being told about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I knew that there was a considerable disagreement within the intelligence agencies over the weapons of mass destruction. I knew that the evidence that the administration was relying on came almost totally from the exile community, which had a very strong conflict of interest, because the only way they were ever going to get back into power was walking in behind a U.S. tank. And I also knew that we didn't have anybody in the United States government, zero, who was inside Iraq checking to see if the information from the exiles was accurate. All those conditions led me to be highly suspicious of what we were hearing, and so I voted no, and I take no positive feelings from the fact that my suspicions have proven to be the facts.
You even, in fact, during that time, continuously opposed the Bush administration on that issue, in particular, the $87 billion for the ongoing war. I remember at that particular time, George Bush wanted and requested $87 billion for the ongoing war on terror.
I voted against that first. I was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. I checked to be sure that there was adequate funds in the pipeline for the troops. Two, I was concerned that this was becoming our war. We were about to own Iraq, and unfortunately, has proven to be increasingly the truth. I also was concerned that the Bush administration didn't want to bring in any serious partners. We had a coalition, but it was not a coalition of equals similar to the one that invaded Iraq in 1991, and that if we were to indicate we were going to pick up the full tab for all the cost, there'd be no incentive for other countries to want to put their soldiers and to put their money at risk in Iraq. So I thought it was a very negative step with serious consequences. It has proven to be so.
Yeah, I remember the Coalition of the Willing, which included the United Kingdom, Uzbekistan, Macedonia, and even Iceland and some others. I was curious about, you said you were suspicious about George Bush's motives at that particular time, and I remember after asking, George Bush asked for the $87 billion, you made a statement about that. You said, quote, "I will support whatever is required for the troops in Iraq. I will not support a dime for the profits of Halliburton." It seems that early on you seemed to know what this was probably about.
Well, I don't think that was all that it was about, but it certainly turned out to be a godsend for those who had been the major financial supporters of the administration, in the case of the vice president before he became vice president, during the campaign and since the 2000 campaign. They were people who were running amok without any control or direction, and they certainly were not serving the interest of either the people of Iraq or the people and taxpayers of the United States of America.
In fact, you said, "I'm ready to say no, hell no, to providing money that is designed to protect profits, not our uniformed men and women." Shortly after the invasion of Iraq, dated March 20th, 2003, you started calling for the impeachment of George Bush. In fact, Senator, you called for George Bush's impeachment on July 27, 2003, on Fox News Sunday. Why were you somewhat...
Well, actually, I tell you the circumstances. I was running for president. It was early July. I was in Concord, New Hampshire, giving a speech at an industrial factory, and a reporter said, "Senator, today the president announced, after he had left for Africa, that the statement that he made in the State of the Union, that we were concerned about enriched uranium flowing from Africa to Iraq, was untrue." Well, do you think President Bush should be impeached because he lied to the American people? My answer was, this same House of Representatives impeached President Bill Clinton. They impeached him for a consensual sexual affair. How would you compare in terms of a threat to the country? The president engaging in a consensual sexual affair, or the president taking the country to war based on what I think were known lies, falsehoods. I don't think there's any question as to which is the more appropriate for impeachment. I then went on to say the reality is, however, that this Republican Congress is never going to impeach George Bush, and therefore that shouldn't be our objective. Our objective should be to try to exercise the greatest degree of control over this wrong-headed war that he's gotten us into. But I think this, there's no question now that this president's going to go down as one of the worst in the history of the United States. In fact, it's hard to think of who the other candidates for that last on the list will be.
Senator Graham, would you call George Bush flat out a liar?
I think he misled the country. He could not have been in the position that he was without knowing how soft the evidence was to justify a war on weapons of mass destruction against Iraq. At least he owed the American people the honesty of saying, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, and it's on this evidence that I'm going to send your young men and women into battle.
The reason I asked that particular question, Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois was with you, I believe, on Fox Sunday, the news, and he said that, quote, evidence doesn't support Graham's comments about impeachment. In fact, Senator Durbin said, quote, there's absolutely no evidence that the president knowingly misled the American people. So my question is, did George Bush knowingly mislead? Because if he knowingly misled...
Well, I can't believe that the president of the United States hadn't been curious enough to ask some questions, like, why is it that the Department of Energy disagrees with what the CIA is telling me about whether there is a resurrection of Iraq's nuclear program? That he wasn't curious enough to ask, what is the background of this information about enriched uranium going from Africa to Iraq? He would have found out that the International Atomic Energy Agency had discounted it almost instantaneously after having it presented. He should have been sufficiently respectful of the American people to tell them we're going to war in Iraq based on information almost totally provided to us by exiles, many of whom haven't lived in Iraq in 10 or 20 years, and all of whom have a very strong conflict of interest because they want us to go to war. That's the only way they're going to get back in power. I believe that those are all misstatements. I would describe them as being lies. The president told the American people to build the case to go to war in Iraq, a war that has been so tragically conducted and with such tragic circumstances and long-term consequences to our nation.
And it appears that his not being curious about those particular questions could lead one to suggest that he knowingly misled, meaning he lied flat out.
I think here's what his problem was. The American people saw airplanes fly into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon. They saw one fall in the field in Pennsylvania. They knew that we'd been attacked, and they quickly knew that we were attacked by Al-Qaeda. The country rallied. We passed a very strong authorization to use military force against any group that had been complicit in 9/11. In October of 01, we launched one of the most devastating aerial assaults in the history of mankind against Afghanistan, and its government quickly crumbled. Then, for reasons that are still unknown, this administration decided we shouldn't be fighting against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but rather we should fight against Iraq and Saddam Hussein. They had to come up with some reason to convince the American people to leave the field of battle where our enemy that had just killed 3,000 of our fellow citizens occupied to go over to Iraq. And the administration decided the way to do it is to scare the American people, to terrorize them with the threat that weapons of mass destruction are going to be used against them soon, directly in the homeland, unless we invade and take down this government. And incidentally, after we've done that invasion and take down, the people of Iraq will throw roses and flowers on our tanks. We'll be welcomed as we were in Paris in 1944. We'll be able to leave, and democracy will flourish in Iraq and then throughout the Middle East. That's what we were told. Without that series of lies, I don't think the American people would have tolerated us leaving Afghanistan, where our real enemy was, is, and continues to be in an increasingly stronger and stronger form.
You stated that George Bush terrorized the American people. From an academic point of view and a legal or customary definition of terrorism, has George Bush committed terrorism on the Iraqi people?
I don't think he's committed an indictable offense of terrorism, but I think he used the fear generated by his very depictive descriptions of the weapons that were about to be used against us to cause the American people to recalibrate their feelings of who our enemy was, to believe that our enemy was Saddam Hussein, even believing that maybe he had something to do with 9/11. So I think the president clearly conducted and effectively conducted a propaganda campaign to convince the American people that our enemy was in Iraq, while our true enemy in Afghanistan and Pakistan was left to run virtually free.
You said that you didn't think that George Bush committed an indictable offense of terrorism on the Iraqi people. What is, in fact, an indictable offense of terrorism on any people?
Well, you know, we've got several hundred people around the world who are being held in detention because they were defined as combatants in an army of terrorists against us, the United States of America, as its principal enemy. That's what I would call an indictable offense. What the president has done is he really has misled the country into this war, which was a mistake when it was first proposed, and it wasn't first proposed in October of 2002. It at least was being under active engagement as early as February of 2002, as we began to move our troops and equipment out of Afghanistan to get ready for a war that wouldn't start for 13 months in Iraq.
I'm curious because, you know, when Al-Qaeda attacked the United States of America on 9/11, or that is what the government has led us to believe, we consider that an act of terrorism, and I think many feel justified in considering that an act of terrorism, an indictable offense. The Iraqi people, if the Iraqi people have been attacked by the United States of America, are they justified for considering that the United States has committed an act of terrorism against them? And would that not be an indictable offense of terrorism?
Well, this is not a legalistic issue. This is a moral question, a question of appropriate behavior by the greatest force in the world, the United States, and a tragic, desperate failure of leadership to use this great power in a way that will best protect the security of the United States and advance the cause of peace throughout the world.
Well, you know, I always thought it was interesting. You said it was not a legal question, and I always think about the United Nations and the international law. And in fact, George Bush offered one of the reasons for attacking Iraq was that Saddam Hussein was illegally having weapons of mass destruction. And it's interesting you don't consider it a legal question at this particular point, but George Bush certainly did.
Well, you were talking about the issue of whether our invasion of Iraq would be a punishable event by some international court. My answer to that question is no, but there are a lot of other courts of judgment in which this is going to be reviewed.
Yeah, and it really concerns me because I'm trying to figure out how we need to best move at this point. What do you suggest, Senator Graham? What can we do at this particular point as far as, one, impeachment, and two, what needs to happen with the United States in Iraq?
Well, if the we in that sentence is the people of the United States, one, as I had suggested back in July of 2003, while I believe by legal standards what President Bush has done is a much more reprehensible violation of our Constitution than what Bill Clinton did, I don't think that impeachment was going to happen as long as the Republicans were in control, and I think now the Democrats are in control, their focus ought to be on how do we end this war with whatever honor we can do so, and move quickly and aggressively to continue the war against the people that actually are our threats. And they happen to live over in Afghanistan and Pakistan, not in Iraq, other than the ones that we have stimulated to come to Iraq to participate in the misbegotten war that we started.
It sounds similar to because Nancy Pelosi, she stated on May 10th, 2006, who's House Speaker, of course, she indicated she was not interested in pursuing impeachment and she had taken it off the table. As of May 18th, 2006, House Judiciary Committee Chair John Conyers, his current position seems to be that rather than seeking impeachment, he said, I have chosen to propose comprehensive oversight of these alleged abuses. You would agree with Nancy Pelosi and John Conyers?
I would, and frankly, in this last commutation for Scooter Libby adds another nail in this coffin. I think the president has effectively relinquished the office of president. He has the title, but he doesn't have the influence, even increasingly within his own party. He doesn't have the confidence of the American people to lead. I would say this is a presidency of toleration and waiting the clock out. This is like a baseball team that's into August and is 25 games out of first place. They're just playing out the rest of the schedule. Well, I think President Bush is, whether he intends it or not, or whether he even knows it or not, it's basically what he's doing.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned this issue of Scooter Libby. On July 3rd, 2007, Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. of Illinois, he announced, quote, with the president's decision to once again subvert the legal process and the will of the American people by commuting the sentence of convicted felon Louis Scooter Libby, I call on House Democrats to reconsider impeachment proceedings, end quote. So the senator, the congressman here, Jesse Jackson,
well,
is saying because of the
Scooter. I know Congressman Jackson. I have a lot of respect for him and his family, but the reality is the president has already not only impeached himself, he's impeached himself and he's had the post-impeachment trial, and he convicted himself, and he's still occupying the White House physically, but that's about all.
And that's about it, huh? He's pretty much gone. He's done a lot of damage to his political party, hasn't he?
It's amazing for a president who came in with his sidekick, Karl Rove, to permanently reconfigure American politics so that there would be a continuing Republican majority as far as the eye can see. He's just about done the opposite. I don't know of a period in which a political party has been so crushed in such a short period of time by such a small group of willful men and a few willful women.
I know you must go, Senator Graham. I know it was only for 30 minutes. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I want to ask you one last question, if you don't mind. Senator Graham, do you still have your Florida orange juice always on hand, and do you still wear your trademark Florida tie?
The answer is, I'm afraid to say we don't have our Florida orange juice always on hand. When I was governor and then in the Senate, we had an orange juice machine right outside my office for our guest and, frankly, for me. But I do still wear the Florida ties, and Malik, you would be a better person. You would be pumped up with pride if you, too, would wear a Florida tie.
Oh, one more, please, if you don't mind. I know time is up. Hey, who are you voting for? Who do you think you're going to
vote for? I haven't endorsed anybody yet. I know all the Democratic candidates personally, except for Senator Obama. We've talked on the phone a few times, and I look forward to a chance to meet him. But until I've done that, I'm not going to make it to see you.
Well, thank you, Senator. I certainly appreciate your spending this time on The People Speak. And please come back at least, give us a call, or we'll give you a call to see what you're up to. I know you're up to so many things, and we'd love to hear from you.
Great. Thanks, Malik. Best wishes. And one day late, best wishes for the 4th of July, America's birthday.
Thank you. Thank you, okay. Senator. You take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief office I saw my people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.